Joining me now is conductor Andrew Kohler, who is leading an ambitious program Saturday night in Chenery Auditorium called Of Gods and Men, a presentation of the Kalamazoo Philharmonia and the Bach Festival Society of Kalamazoo. Well, good morning to you.
Good morning, Kara. Thanks for having me.
There are just two works on the program, but wow, they're both masterpieces in their own right.
Absolutely are, and they're huge undertakings, and it's really, this is the first time that these two organizations have collaborated, and I'm just intensely excited to see these two groups together and to sing this magnificent repertoire.
Well, as you are, you must have an office in the Light Fine Arts building at Kalamazoo College, which is in the same hallway as the Kalamazoo Bach Festival.
That's exactly right. They're actually in the hallway just above us. So, But easily connected by a stairwell. We see them all the time. And obviously, the way it works is that the Bach Festival, though it is a separate entity, it is led, of course, by Jim Turner. And Jim Turner, part of Jim Turner's appointment at the college is conducting this Bach Festival. So it really is sort of an extension of Kalamazoo College. So it seems like a very natural fit. Here we have the orchestra of Kalamazoo College, the chorus that's sort of related to Kalamazoo College, and to put them finally together is something that I've wanted to do for a long time. And finally, all the pieces came together, and we couldn't be more excited about this Saturday's concert.
Well, we will be talking a little later about the great work that Daphnis and Chloe is, the ballet by Maurice Ravel that's on the program, and it's a showcase for the Kalamazoo Philharmonia. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about the collaboration first. And before you got here and during last hour's music, I was touting the Cherubini as a masterpiece by a little known composer, and I would wonder if you'd take up the baton and continue with that idea.
Well, I was absolutely floored, because I have to confess to you and to the listeners that I did not know the Cherubini Requiem at all before about a year ago when I finally decided to do this. When Jim Turner and I finally decided that we might collaborate this year, we tried to think of suitable repertoire. We obviously wanted to look in a direction where we could use an orchestra that was somewhat bigger than what the Bach Festival was generally used to having. And something probably that used slightly larger forces than Bach typically would have. Of course, the Bach Festival has often ventured farther away from Bach in certain years. I mean, that is its bread and butter, so to speak. But I think one of the great things about a Bach Festival is that it can celebrate the fact that Bach sort of reverberates in the music of practically every composer that follows him. So we wanted to look for some repertoire that would use a larger orchestra. And we looked at several different options. And then I just kept sort of, looking through books, trying to find other pieces. And then I came across this Cherubini Requiem. And I started reading up on it and hearing things like Beethoven saying that had he ever written a requiem, surely his model would not have been Mozart's. He did not mention Mozart's, but would have been Cherubini's. He was so awestruck by this. And now, knowing the work better, I see all these interesting qualities in it that are also reflected in the Brahms German Requiem, for example. Chief among them, the fact that Cherubini does not use violins in the opening movements, just in the same way that Brahms eventually did not use violins to give the orchestration a slightly darker hue. So there are definitely homages in Brahms. And you start thinking, how strange is this? Every once in a while, music history's judgment, it seems very unjust. And this surely is one of those times. I think this Cherubini is an absolutely beautiful work that perfectly captures its time period. That is to say, the period of the restoration of the monarchy after the French Revolution. This is really a requiem in homage of Louis XIV and his execution. And it also captures that time period as democracy is on the rise, that we are, music is shifting from the classical era that had continued to be more directed towards a music for the aristocracy to finally a music of the people, so to speak, in the more revolutionary, democratized sense of the 19th century. And I think there's a lot in this work that still has the balance and the proportion and the rationality and the sheer beauty that one expects from classical, that is to say, capital C, Mozart, Haydn era music. But at the same time, there are there's a sense of pathos and a sense of urgency in the music that very much speaks to the romantic spirit. And I think that's why Beethoven admired it so much. He was also a figure on that same threshold, experimenting with the same ideas.
This Requiem was written in 1816, I think.
Right.
Right around there. And so we are talking about a lot of upheavals and political happenings. Beethoven himself at that time must have been writing some of his later masterpieces himself.
That's right. Yeah, so he would have been entering the final decade of his life at that point.
But Cherubini was born in 1860, 4 years before Mozart.
And so 1760, yeah,
like,
right.
Like I said, yeah. 1760. So he did pick up that, you know, that was his sound world, the Mozart.
Absolutely, Haydn. Absolutely. And I think that's clearly reflected in this piece. But at the same time, I think one of the things I hope we'll have a chance to listen to is the beginning of the sequentia, the Dies Irae, of course, maybe the most sort of crucial movement to a requiem as opposed to a mass ordinary. And the way he begins it with this incredible fanfare from the brass and the use of a gong, of a tam-tam, which is in a literal sense, a stroke very much outside of the sacred tradition. I think there is an effort there to head towards, as philosophers of the time would have thought of it, the sublime, you know, away from the rational and towards the sublime, something that arouses the senses. And there's a lot in that movement that really conjures the fear of that day of wrath, which is, of course, what Dies Irae means. And at the same time, there's also, I think the Agnus Dei at the end is a very unusual and very interesting setting, because the Agnus Dei, of course, Lamb of God, one typically thinks of that as a very conciliatory, very peaceful sort of setting. And yet Cherubini's is anything but. It's quietly turbulent and unsettled and almost a little bit obsessive. It keeps repeating itself. And the end, there's no clearer depiction that I can think of someone who is unwilling to let go. He just won't end the piece, and he just sort of stays on this practically static tonic pedal for bars and bars and bars until the whole thing just sort of melts away at the end.
Oh, Andrew, we need a taste of this.
Sounds great.
Where would you like to start?
Well, I think actually, even though the first movement is very much in keeping with this sort of quieter requiem sensibility, I think we should just go for the jolt and start right with the Dies Irae.
We've heard the Dies Irae movement of the Cherubini Requiem in C minor, and if you've just turned in during that music, it's a work on the program this Saturday starting at 8 o'clock in Chenery Auditorium, featuring the Kalamazoo Bach Festival Chorus as well as the Kalamazoo Philharmonia. It's a collaboration led by my guest here today, Andrew Kohler, the chorus having been prepared by Jim Turner.
Exactly right. Yeah. Yes.
Well, you know, I have to confess, when I saw the interview on my schedule today, I got out the Cherubini and listened to the first movement for about three minutes, and I thought to myself, oh, very much like Mozart, or, you know, very kind of classically predictable, not to use that in a pejorative way, but what we just heard was the revolutionary side, the passion stirring,
absolutely the sublime, attempting to arouse emotions, and I think it does that so amazingly successfully. That, you know, of course, he's very flexible in the way that he sets the various parts of text. We start with the Dies Irae, which is very, and then he returns to similar iterations of that music for the Rex Tremendi, the great king. But in the middle, there are more gentle sections. And certainly at the very end, we heard a shift to a very different kind of music, and that's for the Lacrimosa. And it's, I think he's a very sensitive text setter, and he manages to use still sort of very logical musical models, you know, ones with enough repetition so that there's an inherent musical logic to it, but ones that are nonetheless sensitive and reflective of the text that he's setting. And I absolutely think that beginning is just, you know, unfortunately the listeners right now aren't getting the full effect, but one would, of course, at the concert this Saturday, and that is that the first two movements, like I mentioned, don't use violins. They use a very pared down orchestra. And as you pointed out, by listening to the first movement, they tend to be much more introverted on the quieter side. That makes the effect of that, those blaring brass and the gong at the beginning of this movement, that much more stirring.
Luigi Cherubini, he actually got a pretty good deal, even though he's not as prominent today as some of his contemporaries. He had a long career, mm-hmm. In prominent positions, and was, you know, considered one of the best composers of his day. So
absolutely,
it didn't come out so badly in the end.
No, certainly not. But it's very interesting. You know, we have such a it's a very romantic kind of idea that stays with us. But we have this notion that a genius is always unappreciated in his day, which of course is not always very true. I think the archetype for that is Beethoven, but it's very misleading to say that Beethoven wasn't respected in his day. Only at the end, maybe some of the late works met with some quizzical reception. But even that quizzical reception was always tempered by people recognizing that Beethoven was the most incredible composer of his day. Went so far as when there was a threat looming that he might move out of Vienna and go somewhere else, that a series of very rich princes and dukes conspired to basically pay him a salary to stay in Vienna so that he could continue representing Vienna. But anyway, that's very much the case with Cherubini, that he was very well respected in his day. And in fact, he was the first head of the Paris Conservatory that was founded in the early 19th century. And even though Berlioz chafed a little under, and you know, because Berlioz was the sort of next generation's firebrand, so he wanted to take the revolution still further, of course, and did so with that with the Symphonie Fantastique, which is a magnificent but very strange piece for the time, and not that much later than this work. So he obviously thought of Cherubini as the old guard, but Cherubini had already paved some of the way for someone like Berlioz to take the next steps.
I did not realize he was the first head of the Paris Conservatoire. Mm-hmm. Wow. So about 100 years later, not quite, we're talking 1912, 1911, we're in Paris again.
That's right. Exactly right.
And Maurice Ravel gets a call from Serge Diaghilev and Ballet Russe. Mm-hmm.
And ends up writing what is, I think, his most magnificent score. It's often called sort of a symphony ballet, just because of the amazing amount of complexity and thoughtfulness. And in fact, enough so that this score is very often played on stage, that is to say, not as a ballet anymore. I think it's far more popular on the concert stage these days than it is as ballet, just because the music is so searingly gorgeous and inventive and compelling that it works perfectly. Sometimes, you know, you transfer the ballet to the concert stage and you extract a suite of the best bits, but there's still some parts in it that are of primarily choreographic interest and don't quite work as well musically. Not so here. There's barely a note that isn't riveting in this piece.
Is it the full ballet that you are performing?
It's not the full ballet, because that is just about an hour of music. And with the Cherubini, which is already 45 minutes, that seemed like a very intense program, a lot to listen to. So what we've done is essentially take the beginning and the end of the ballet. So we are performing the very first part of the ballet, and then we're performing the very last part of the ballet, a total about half of it, about a half hour, and we cut out the middle half hour. and gives a very nice overview, I think, of the beauty in the music. And we're performing in such a way that it's more or less seamless. I hope I found an appropriate moment so that we can sort of link from one part to the next without it seeming obvious that there's some big cut happening. I should mention very briefly before we completely leave the Cherubini that one of the things that's also very striking about this piece is that it's just the chorus singing the entire time. Very unusual procedure. Of course, almost every Requiem that we think of has soloists as well. So it's an enormously taxing sing for the Bach Festival Chorus, as Jim has been telling me over and over again. it's just, it takes a lot of stamina. And even in the middle of the Dies Irae, there we heard some moments where there's just a single line of either the tenors or just all the sopranos and altos together singing, which one imagines would have very much been the moment for a soloist to sing. But instead, Cherubini is sort of resolute in making sure that everything is set for the full chorus.
That's odd. He wrote operas.
Absolutely.
He had access to great musicians of
absolutely.
All kinds.
I confess I'm not really sure what his thinking was. I don't know if he thought perhaps it was more appropriate to the sacred tradition, although there were plenty of examples, of course, in the sacred tradition of solo singing mixed with choral singing, or whether maybe there was some, I hesitate to say this because it's wild conjecture, but, you know, some subtle democratizing spirit going on there. Of course, he was still honoring Louis XIV, and he himself lived a very good life under the, as sort of court composer, and I think, you know, very much was relieved at the restoration of the monarchy, as reasonably enough, as I imagine many French citizens, no matter what their political leanings would have been after the terror that ensued after the revolution. Nevertheless, maybe there's some small sort of nod towards the democratizing spirit and having the whole chorus sing the entire time.
Oh, I like it. The people's mass,
you know. And he was actually chastised by the church for including women's voices. So the next Requiem he wrote, the one that he wrote for himself, only uses men's voices. But
I'm glad I didn't push you off the topic
entirely. No, I apologize for being so stubborn. I just wanted to say those last few things about the Cherubini before we return now to the Ravel.
Well, actually, let me say we haven't mentioned this, but listeners, please follow up if this program interests you at KalamazooBachFestival.org, where there is more information on Saturday's concert. It is in Chenery Auditorium,
that's right,
which is a great opportunity to hear these forces assembled in a beautiful space. More information on tickets also available at 337-7407, which is the Bach Festival office.
Exactly right.
All right, so shall we move on?
Yes. So back to the Ravel. It's just an absolutely magnificent work. And, you know, I want to tie this all back to this title of Gods and Men. Why this title? So, of course, we've already talked about the Cherubini Requiem. And I think the presence of the sacred is fairly clear that this is a Requiem Mass in the Catholic tradition. And also, I think there's an interesting sort of secondary meaning there in that this is being written in honor of the executed Louis XIV. So it's he himself, of course, was at the time a god among men in many ways. There's no question, to me at least, that I hear a sense of Cherubini at least considering his own mortality in this work, as I think any human being would be wont to do, writing a Requiem Mass, considering the implications of death and life. But here, too, when we skip forward to a very different France, of course, 100 years later, Maurice Ravel is also writing a story of gods and men, because this is basically a fantastical recreation, a sort of imaginative recreation, I should say, of Greece in Ravel's mind. And he's writing a story about the shepherds, Daphnis and Chloe, the titular characters, and their love affair. And it's a very simple story. Basically, Daphnis is a bit shy, but likes Chloe very much, approaches her, and has to compete with a few other suitors who come on the scene. And then pirates steal Chloe away, and he has to find some way to get her back. And this happens basically through the intervention of the god Pan. because Pan, who had loved Syrinx, sort of intervenes because he sees in their love a kind of reflection of his own. And to honor that, Daphnis and Chloe do a pantomime sort of Pan's, of course, famous for being a flutist. This is why this has such a long and beautiful flute solo in this piece. Recreate that sort of that love affair of Pan in homage to him for having helped them. And then, of course, there's much merrymaking and joyous raucous music. What I love particularly about this piece is that it's just Ravel at his very best. And three of the things he does extremely well, which are abundantly apparent in this music. One, the thing that he's very famously credited for all the time, which is orchestration. And, it's incredible. I made a mention the very first time we played this with the orchestra, we got to a really loud passage, and I said, it almost somehow doesn't matter what we do. It sounds great. It's virtually foolproof the way he writes it. I mean, that's not to say that it's not extremely difficult to play, because it is extremely difficult to play. But there is something where all these minuscule interlocking parts, some of which are very difficult to execute, some of which are very unrewarding on their own, linked together in this larger tapestry. I'm not even sure how he has the ability to see how all these parts would work together and create just the most incredibly textured, colorful, beautiful picture. And the other two things are specific sort of kinds of music that are very well captured. One is that sort of searing, slow, sumptuous beauty. And that's never more apparent than in the Evocation of Sunrise, which kind of comes in the midway point of our suite and begins the second suite that he himself extracted from the ballet. And then at the very end, the general dance is raucous and energetic, an off-kilter dance in 5-4 that just has this tremendous thrust that propels the listener all the way to the very final notes.
You said something about how can he do it. That's always the impression I've gotten when I've listened to Daphnis and Chloe I don't know how it's done. It's just like this world has suddenly been created in front of me, and I've no clue how it's all coming together. It's so detailed and so amazing, and it moves along somehow, but it's a miracle.
I feel the same way each time I get to conduct it.
So I was thinking about Daphnis and Chloe and that frankly terrifying flute solo.
Yeah, that's right. You must know it well, I'm sure.
But I am glad to hear that some of it actually it just works and is easy as well. I mean, I wouldn't want this to be the thing that makes an orchestra sweat the most, that is the most beautiful to hear.
You know? Yeah. Well, I mean, it's been a really, I'll tell you very honestly, it's been a big challenging process for us. You know, I've worked with some people even individually in the orchestra who have said, why are so many notes? And I sympathize richly. I know there are, for example, in that I made reference to the Evocation of Sunrise, which I hope we'll get a chance to listen to, and begins the second suite. And there are all these sort of very difficult to describe, these sort of like little waterfalls of notes. Very difficult. The flutes played, the clarinets played. This is a famous excerpt for the clarinets. These poor guys work so hard to make sure they can get it out. And then the strings have to play, and there's just so many notes, and they go so fast. And they're divided into four different parts, so everyone basically is playing different notes, and it's incredibly complicated patterns, very difficult to execute, takes so much work. And it's very daunting because you feel like, well, I don't even know really how this fits in the whole picture. It seems so tangential to the main event, which is this gorgeously rising line in the violas initially and then in the violins later. But you just sort of tell everyone, take a deep breath, look at the larger picture, and wait and listen for everything else that goes on stage. That's the thing. If you're so concentrated on your own part, you'll miss the fact that what's happening around you is truly beautiful in the aggregate. But I think we finally got into a place where we're starting to hear that beauty and enjoy everyone's own very difficult contribution to the overall tapestry.
The concert, again, is at 8 o'clock on Saturday, this Saturday, in Chenery Auditorium. And more information on tickets and more is at KalamazooBachFestival.org or by calling 337-7407. And let's hear a little bit of the morning
sunrise.
Sunrise.
Yes.
We've just listened to music of Daphnis and Chloe, the morning sunrise. Mm-hmm. So perfect.
Gosh, it's amazing.
I don't really have any comments. It's just so good.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel. Like I say, every time that I'm up there conducting it, that, you know, there's that incredible sort of murmuring that we hear, like I described in the flutes and clarinets, and then later in the strings, and you hear birds chirping, of course, in the piccolo and some violin solos, and that rising line that sort of leads us to, I guess, you know, of course, this is a musical sunrise, which means there's sort of two in a row. it's obviously not a literal depiction. But for me, that theme that we hear in the first in the violas and then later in the violins is so searingly gorgeous. And it's just the purest distillation of passion I can imagine.
When you're playing music, when you're conducting music, you have a lot on your mind. You're looking at the page, you're thinking about the phrase coming up and counting right to get to the next phrase. And maybe you were a little flat on the note before and you're thinking about, oh, I should have corrected that ages ago. And you've got so many things running through your head during a performance. Do you ever have a chance to take a little moment and say, I'm so happy right now. This makes me so happy.
In the best performances, yes. I think this is something I talk to many of my students about a lot. I think one of the greatest challenges, a sort of almost catch-22 setup that we've made for ourselves in music, is that we are so dedicated to perfection, working so hard to get things right. And in order to do that, we necessarily have to be very self-critical, very self-aware at all times, right? So in the practice room, I'm constantly telling my violin students or any students, no, you've got to listen, you've got to think, you've got to analyze, you've got to figure out what went wrong, you've got to figure out how to fix it, you've got to do all these things step by step, methodically, really make sure that you correct what things are going wrong and make your practice as effective as possible. And that's all true. I stand by that. And when you get to the performance, you have to forget all of that. You have to put it all behind. And much like I was talking about the players in the orchestra who were concerned with their own individual parts, and I said, no, stop. You know, I mean, do the best you can, learn it, you know, figure it out in the practice room, but then come and then stop worrying about your part and listen to what goes on around you, listen to the whole picture. That has to happen at the performance. And it's not an easy transition to make, but in the best performances, we can let go of all of that baggage. We can trust in the work that we've already done and hope that it stays there, that it remains in our muscle memories, and that what we can do is instead enjoy the moment. That's the thing that will come across to the listeners, and that's the thing that really this whole enterprise is about, and it's incredible how easy it can be to forget that. Just because we're so mired in the details, but we have to step back and see the whole forest.
There really is a lot of, you know, critical thinking going on when you're working on your parts and when you're trying to blend in during rehearsals and stay together and follow the conductor. And that it's another trick to realize, wait a sec, we just began the performance for people, for the right. audience, and
that the whole reason we've done all this work is so that we could enjoy this moment, so that we could be here and say, wow, this really is beautiful.
May I posit that because a lot of the orchestra is volunteers, members of the orchestra are volunteers, that they get this sense, perhaps more than a professional orchestra, where the difference between a rehearsal and a performance, they might not see it as much.
I think it's possible. I mean, there's no question that it would depend on the professional orchestra, but I think there's, you know, when we look at, for example, the incredible success of the Simón Bolívar Youth Orchestra or something, the way it toured around the world, I think one of the reasons why everyone loved hearing that group so much was because they were still more in tune, more in touch with that fundamental love, you know, not so far removed from it. It hadn't become too much of a sort of daily event yet, you know? I mean, that excitement, that enthusiasm, and that primal connection to the beauty of music, I think, is something that I hope very much we'll be able to achieve this Saturday night.
Well, I think every one of your orchestra members is really lucky to get to play this music at such, it's such high level music and so ambitious, and to play it for you, as a wonderful conductor. So.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you. I hope that, I hope they believe that too. And I hope that they'll join me in feeling incredibly lucky to be able to do this music. It's been such a pleasure to do this, this collaboration. And of course, you know, those listeners who were hearing very finely would have noticed that there is a chorus, of course, in this this collaboration continues. It's not just the Cherubini. Very often the Ravel is done without the choral parts or with them removed just because it's more practical and it's simpler to do. But we're obviously very excited to have them in there. They don't have any text in particular. They're just singing wordlessly. But it's another masterstroke on Ravel's part in terms of an orchestrational addition that just makes the orchestra sound that much more incredible. I mean, it's just another sort of instrument in the orchestra, so to speak, but a really wonderful one. It's so evocative.
Did Ravel write anything larger or longer than this ballet in his life?
Not that I know of, not that I can think of.
This is the biggest piece he wrote.
I think so.
Almost 55 minutes in the
full
length.
That's right, yeah.
Well, that brings us to the end of our hour. I'm trying to think of more questions to keep you here, but I'm sure you have other things to do. Listeners, a reminder that more information on the concert, which is this Saturday, June 1st at 8 o'clock, is online at kalamazoobachfestival.org or by calling 269-337-7407. Final thoughts?
I hope everyone's there. We can't wait.
Let's finish with the, is this the last moment of this opera, of this ballet?
Of the ballet, yes, this is the last general dance. And it's a very nice counterpoint, I think, to the music that we've just heard. That is to say, that was so sort of sultry and languid and beautiful, and this is just pure energy right to the end.
Thank you, Andrew.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Kara.